Thank you, Alex, for the introduction and the invitation to give a talk here. I'm Leo. I'm from Caltech, and today I will be talking about quantum advantages in minimization of energies. As many of you probably know, looking for computational advantages of quantum computers in a useful problem has been a central challenge of our field. And today I'm happy to share some recent results we have regarding quantum advantages in a very fundamental problem. And this is a problem of energy minimization. So broadly and generally speaking, the problem of energy minimization is you're given some domain of states or degrees of freedom that you have access to, and you have an energy function that map elements of the domain to a real number which can represent the energy or the cost or the loss. And you want to find a configuration in the domain such that the energy is minimized. So you can imagine that this is a very fundamental problem in many fields, and indeed that's the case. For example, if you consider looking at degrees of freedom that are, for example, a bit string or a set of real numbers, this represents sort of the minimization of a many-body classical system. And this underlies actually basically a lot of problems in our economy today. For example, you can cast problem like route planning or minimize loss in a portfolio of stocks, or even just looking at something like the resource allocation in the energy grid. You can all cast these problems as minimizing the energy of some many-body classical system. But additionally, one can consider domains such as a set of quantum states. And this appears in fields like quantum chemistry and many-body physics. And finding sort of better low-energy states of these quantum systems could lead to development of better pharmaceuticals or materials. So that could be also very important in a use case of looking at sort of quantum advantages. So in this talk, I would like to ask the question, is there a way to minimize energy better with quantum computers? And perhaps surprisingly, there's a lot of classical algorithms already that are already, maybe surprisingly successful. For example, if you look at the problem of minimizing energy of classical systems, a plethora of classical algorithms have already been developed, and this includes linear programming, semi-definite programming relaxation methods, gradient descent, Bayesian optimization, simulated annealing, and the list goes on and on. And so even though, in the worst cases, minimizing energy of classical systems is NP-hard, these classical algorithms still nevertheless seem to do pretty well in a lot of cases that we care about. But even maybe more surprisingly, if you look at something that's fundamentally quantum, like minimizing energy of many-body quantum systems, a lot of classical algorithms have also been developed. This includes tensor network methods, DMRG, quantum Monte Carlo, DFT, and optimization over neural network ansatz, for example. So despite the fact that these problems are maybe one might think fundamentally quantum, these classical computational methods have already given us a lot of insight into many-body physics that basically is most of our understanding of a lot of chemistry and material science is only based on classical methods these days. So the question then, is there any advantages in any sort of use cases of minimizing energy of either classical or quantum systems, where maybe using a quantum computer could actually give us a computational advantage? So today's talk will tell you some recent theoretical results that actually gave some rigorous evidence to the positive for this answer to this question. So specifically for the problem of minimizing energy of classical systems, I will tell you some results where we show a quantum advantage of finding the near ground states of certain classical spin glasses. And for the problem of minimizing energy of quantum many-body systems, we'll tell you about a very recent result from last year where we show that finding the local minimum of a quantum system is actually gives us a quantum advantage. So the talk will then proceed in two parts. So the first part will be about the problem of minimizing energy of classical system, and this is based on work done with colleagues at Google, MIT, UChicago, and Berkeley. So the problem we consider is max cut, and This is actually a problem that comes from graph theory and computer science, but you can also think of it as minimizing the energy of some diluted spin glass. So the problem is defined as follows. So you're given a graph, and you want to find a bipartition of vertices that cuts the most number of edges. And the cost function, or the energy function that you can sort of write down is sort of as follows. You have a sum over edges. And each edge contributes one if the two bits that live on the vertices disagree, and zero if they agree. So here the Zi and Zjs are either plus or minus one, so they represent a classical bit degree of freedoms. And you can it's not hard to see that this is equivalent to minimizing the energy of some antiferromagnetic Ising model. So for this problem, it turns out that a lot of classical computer scientists have worked on kind of developing efficient algorithms, and the early work actually look at just a simple strategy of random guessing, and it's not too hard to see that random guessing on any graph can actually guarantee you getting a bit string that gives you a cut that's at least one half times the size of the maximum. So, and it turns out this is actually, very hard to improve upon. Even if you look at something more sophisticated, like greedy search, this is still the best performance guarantee you can get in the worst case. So this was the state of the art for decades until a seminal work by two computer scientists, Goemans and Williamson, where they show that using the technique of semi-definite programming relaxation, you can actually guarantee a worst case kind of approximation ratio of at least 0.878. And this is the current state of the art for worst case guarantees. So we're interested in kind of looking at what quantum computation can bring to the table. So for that, we consider a problem that is known as the sorry, an algorithm that's known as the quantum approximate optimization algorithm, or QAOA. So the idea is actually very simple. So you're given so if you give me any graph problem where you have some energy that's defined in terms of the bits on the graph, the first thing you do is you promote each bit to a qubit, and then what you do is you initialize them in the so-called plot state, and you apply a sequence of unitaries as follows. So the first unitary that you apply is simply the evolution under the energy function in the computational basis. And the second is a mixing unitary, which in the original proposal is chosen to be basically a global single qubit X rotation done in parallel. And the idea is you apply these operations over P layers according to some parameters, gamma and beta, and then you measure the quantum state in the computational basis to get a bit string. And the hope is that by choosing good parameters, gamma and beta, you can try to maximize the energy function or minimize, depends on how the problem is formulated. You want to basically choose, in this case, we're looking at Maxka, so let's think about maximization. So you want to basically choose the parameters gamma and beta so that the output bit string that you get gives energy function that's maximized. So you might ask, okay, so this algorithm is kind of peculiar, and like why is there a way to actually choose these parameters? So I'm not going to talk about it too much today, because there's actually many heuristics that exist to efficiently choose good parameters. For example, one proposal that I had back in 2018 is that we can actually exploit some patterns in the optimal parameters for many classes of problems and use something like interpolation between depth to actually develop kind of optimization strategies that can efficiently choose good parameters. And later work has sort of looked at many sort of other approaches that build on this, such as using classical warm start or parameter transfers, or something more sophisticated like graph neural network to predict parameters. So the point is that there's many kind of existing strategies that seem to work quite well to choose good parameters. So we're gonna talk about that today, and we're just gonna assume that we have a way to choose good parameters. But despite the problem, suppose even the problem of choosing parameters is solved, there's still the question of, okay, why do we expect this algorithm to do well, and why do we want to use this algorithm? So for that, there's a few reasons. One is that this algorithm is actually one of the simplest thing you can write down, given a classical energy function, and you're trying to maximize. And this leads to basically many sort of ways to implement this very easily on existing quantum hardware. So this has already been implemented in systems like trapped ions, superconducting qubits, and neutral atoms. And another reason why this is interesting algorithm is that this is actually, can sort of one can show that, what it's impossible to classically sample from the output distribution of the QAOA, even at the lowest sort of depth at p equals one. And so this is sort of similar to the recent sort of proposals of quote unquote quantum supremacy, where, under certain complexity theoretic assumptions, which are considered reasonable, sampling from output distribution of certain quantum circuits is classically hard. So this tells us that this algorithm is in some ways fundamentally quantum in some sense. But perhaps the most important reason why this is interesting, an algorithm, is because as we can kind of tell, this algorithm only can improve monotonically when you add more layers, when the number of layers p increases. And this is because you can always reproduce a lower number of layers using a higher depth circuit by just setting some of the parameters to be zero. And one can also show that as the number of layers p increases to infinity, you can prove that there's a way to choose parameters that guarantee you to get the maximum energy state regardless of the problem. So this kind of, is very nice because you can kind of think of this as basically a way to guarantee this algorithm to work in the large depth limit. And perhaps, it makes sense to try to run this algorithm at smaller depth to sort of see if it still gets a good performance.
Sorry, can I ask? I guess I just don't have any intuition for why this thing works. So, can you maybe
Okay.
see, like, why do you evolve by? Oh, well.
So maybe
Uh,
I
yeah,
can try to explain.
why the beta X part? Like, what is that doing for you?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. So let me just expand on this point a bit. So the reason why we choose this mixing unitary to be sum of X is because the initial state that we choose is sort of the ground state of this B Hamiltonian. So because of that, you can kind of think of a way to basically make sure this algorithm work in the infinite depth limit is you can choose this gamma and beta parameters in a way so that it approximates Schrödingerized version of an adiabatic algorithm. So you can think of an adiabatic algorithm where you initialize in the B Hamiltonian and you slowly kind of ramp that down, and then you turn on the C, sort of this classical C Hamiltonian, and so that your ground state smoothly evolve from the initial state of all plus to the ground state of the classical sort of energy function. So and because of Perron for Frobenius, there's basically you can guarantee that there's a non-zero gap throughout the whole thing except for the very end. So this kind of shows you that there's a way to at least in the large depth limit for this algorithm to basically find the ground state of any classical energy function.
I see. Okay, that helps.
Yeah, so that sort of naively might require p to scale exponentially with system size, which is obviously not ideal. But still, it's very interesting to understand what happens when the number of layers p is sort of small. And this is sort of one of the reason why this makes this algorithm find it very interesting is because when the QAOA was first proposed in 2014, you were able to actually prove performance guarantees at very low depth. That in a way that's very non-trivial. So these performance guarantees are I'll just kind of briefly reveal this is sort of done using something called the subgraph picture. So what I mean by this is let's consider the max scale problem on a through regular graph, for example. So this is, for example, any graph where the degree of every vertex, so that's the number of neighbors, the coordination number of every vertex is exactly three. And you can see an example on the screen here. So let's consider the lowest depth of QAOA at p equals one. So the performance of this the QAOA algorithm can be evaluated for each of the edge that shows up in the energy function, and that edge, say between edge j and k, contributes the following term to the final expectation of the energy. And in the Heisenberg picture, you can understand this term by looking at the subgraph formed by including all the nodes at most distance p from the edge. So for example, in this case of three regular graph at p equals one, the algorithm only sees the following three types of subgraphs. And to make me maybe make this more concrete example, let's, for example, look at the edge between node 3 and 4. This generates a subgraph of type 2. And if you look at the edge between 8 and 14, this generates a graph, subgraph of type 3. And what this means is that, you know, if you give me a three regular graph, no matter how large it is, you can efficiently iterate through all the edges and classify them according to the subgraph type. And then you can evaluate the performance by just doing sort of this essentially a 6-qubit computation classically, and you can evaluate the performance on basically any problem size without having access to a quantum computer. And this allows basically Farhi, Goldstone, and Gunn, when they proposed the algorithm in 2014, to prove that the worst case guarantee of the QAOA in this case has an approximation ratio of at least 0.6924. And you can compare this to the algorithm that I mentioned, the classical algorithm that I mentioned earlier. The greedy algorithm gives you a guarantee of 0.5, and the SDP gives you a guarantee of 0.878. So this shows you that this beats sort of the random guessing and greedy algorithm type approach, but it doesn't beat the state of the art, which is semi-definite program. But then again, this is only at the lowest depth, p equals one. And you might imagine, okay, can we take this analysis further by increasing p? And as I mentioned, you can only improve the performance as p increases, and and eventually you will get to the maximum. But this turns out to be very difficult because if you want to take this analysis to higher p, and if you want to analyze this on a classical with only classical resources, the analysis complexity grows doubly exponentially with the depth of the circuit. And you can kind of see this because the size of the subgraph grows exponentially with the depth of the circuit. And then if you want to simulate this expectation value, you need a Hilbert space that grows exponentially in the size of the subgraph, which now becomes doubly exponential. So this becomes essentially impossible even at p equals 3. Okay, so the this worst case analysis is nice, but it seems like has a limited future. How about average case? So what I mean is that if you look at a random graph, maybe you can do something. You can say something more beyond just what you can prove about in the worst case examples. So it turns out that for random max cut problems, there's actually a lot of understanding from classical statistical theory. So if you look at a random deregular graph in the large system size limit. It turns out that several beautiful results from statistical theory predicts that if you look at the maximum cut fraction, which is the size of the max cut normalized by the number of edges, is with high probability 1/2 plus some number over square root of d, where d is the degree of the vertices. So we also actually know that in the large degree limit, result by Giorgio Parisi in the 1970s, which was later made rigorous in the last decade, shows that this number converges to something called the Parisi value for 0.763. So this is a very kind of beautiful result because they actually won Parisi the Nobel Prize in 2021. It is basically because it tells us essentially what the actual max cut value is for essentially any typical random graph that you give me. But this result is non-constructive. So this means that even though we know the ground energy of these this random classical systems, there's currently no algorithm based on just these results to find the ground state bit string that actually achieves that energy. So what is the state of the art classical algorithms to actually try to find a bit string that achieves this energy? Well, it turns out that a lot of people have looked at this. For example, looking at semi-definite programming and local algorithms such as the Gaussian wave process, and without assuming any assumptions, the provable guarantee that these classical algorithms can get is actually turns out to achieve sort of a cut fraction where this number that we care about is t over pi. So you can see that this 2 over pi, which is in decimal is 0.636, is strictly suboptimal compared to the Parisi value. But recently, assuming sort of a conjecture about statistical physics called no OGP, and for maybe for spin glass experts, what this conjecture is saying is basically there's a full replica symmetry breaking in certain spin glass models. So this conjecture, you know, if you assume this, it turns out that you can kind of come up with a local message passing algorithm, which after p rounds of message passing is able to achieve a cut fraction where this number, you know, above the fraction that you care about here, is basically arbitrarily close to the Parisi value with an error that goes down like 1/√p. Okay, so this is the state of the art classically, and we're interested in, you know, how the QAOA might do on this problem. So let's similarly denote the performance of the QAOA by looking at the cut fraction, where again the number that we care about is sort of this number above the second part in the numerator, and we also denote and remember the QAOA has a bunch of variational parameters gamma and beta, and we'll only basically look at the maximum achieved over these set of variational parameters. So there actually has been a number of existing results prior to our work. So for example, at p equals one, if you look at any sort of regular graphs without any triangles, we know that the maximum value that you can achieve by the QAOA is asymptotically 0.303 in the large degree limit. And if you look at depth two QAOA for any graph that is girth, that has girth at least five, so that means that there's no triangles, squares and pentagons in the graph, we know that the QAOA achieves a value that's 0.407. So this, you know, kind of increases as p increases as one expects, but we're still not close to the state of our classical algorithm yet. And here, so I'm saying a lot of things about, you know, triangle free and large girth. You might wonder, okay, why are we talking about this? Well, the reason is because actually, if you're looking at large girth graph, it's almost essentially the same as looking at the random or graph or average case graph in sort of these random regular graph setting. And this is because, you know, if you look at a large random graph, the probability of any neighborhood containing sort of a loop it basically vanishes as the problem size get large. So effectively speaking, you know, you can the performance achieved on this large girth graph is essentially the same as the performance achieved on a random average case regular graph. So in this recent work, we were able to actually take this analysis to basically any arbitrary depth p, and specifically we show the following: for any D-regular graph with sufficiently large girth, we give a sort of a explicit formula that computes the value achieved by the QAOA at any given parameters that uses sort of 16 to the p time and 40 to the p memory, and in the large degree limit, it turns out that this formula simplifies, and you can actually evaluate it only using 40 to the p time which is quadratically better and exponentially better classical memory. So you can see that, you know, despite sort of some of the exponential scaling in P, this is much better than the doubly exponential analysis complexity of the worst case analysis. And sort of just to give you a small flavor of how we achieve this result, the basic idea is that we look at sort of the neighborhood that's sort of induced by looking at what the Heisenberg picture of an operator that shows up in the cost function. And for these regular graphs with large girth, it's essentially a tree, a regular tree. And by using sort of the symmetry and structures of this tree, we can actually come up with a way to analytically contract this tree tensor network very efficiently. And this gave us sort of a way to evaluate these expectation very efficiently compared to the worst case analysis. And you can see that, you know, it turns out that this is independent of system size as well as the degree, at least in the large degree limit. So we took this formula and we're able to, because of the much improved complexity of the analysis, we're able to provide provable results up to a depth of p equals 20. And so these are the values that we get. So at p equals 1 and 2, we agree with previous results that I have shown before. And it sort of only increases better, and we get to 0.68 at p equals 20. And let's plot these values, since we have so many of them on a plot. So here I'm plotting the values achieved by the QA on the y-axis as a function of 1 over p. So as you increase the depth, you go from the bottom right of the plot to the top left. So what's interesting is that, as you can kind of see, maybe if I don't know if the graph is too small, but at p equals 11, the values achieved by the QAOA actually crosses this line of 2 over pi, which, as I mentioned before, is the best proven performance of any assumption-free classical algorithms. And beyond this, you can see that it's still actually increasing steadily, and it seems to approach the pre-C value, which is the ground energy of these classical dilute spin glasses. But as I mentioned, the state of the art actually is not necessarily 2 over pi, because if you assume this so-called no OGB conjecture, which is somewhat believed to be quite reasonable by a lot of statistical physicists, there's a local message passing algorithm, which gets kind of arbitrarily close to the pre-C value with an error that goes down like 1 over square root of p. But you know, as you can see, the quantum algorithm also seems to approach the pre-C value. So let's try to fit, we have so many data points, let's, you know, be physicists for a second and try to fit the data. So one reasonable function to fit would be sort of a power law. And indeed, if we, for example, fit the power law to just actually the data up to p equals 8, we see sort of very good agreement with the data. And it actually, despite the fact that this curve is, you know, fitted from just the data from 1 to 8, he actually agrees with the data from 9 to 17 plotted on this graph up to the, I think, the third or fourth decimal. So this power law also shows that, you know, it seems like the QAOA is able to get to the ground energy for these systems with an error that goes down like 1 over p, the depth, p being the depth. So you can see that this is sort of a quadratic improvement over the state of the art if you assume these conjectures. But if you don't assume any conjecture, certainly we have surpassed the current state of the art classically. So this is very nice, but we actually can take these analysis of sort of looking at average cases to more general problems, which I'll sort of briefly describe. So these more general problems that I'm talking about involves not only two-body couplings between spin degrees of freedom, but potentially, you know, multi-body, like q-body interactions. One example that people have studied is a fully connected a Gaussian spin glass model, where basically you have all-to-all connections with q-body interactions, where the individual coupling J's are chosen as a standard sort of a Gaussian random variables with mean zero. So it turns out that for any J that's drawn from a reasonable distribution with mean zero, we're able to actually compute an exact formula for any sort of constant depth QAOA P, sort of any set of parameters. And so this was shown in the second paper that I cite here in the bottom right. And the idea behind this sort of this formula derivation is based on proving a generalized, so-called generalized multinomial theorem. So to describe this, actually, you know, it's a bit complicated, but you can kind of think of this in a very kind of cute physics way as a rigorous version of a path integral calculation. And the reason is as follows. So if you look at any expectation of some observable in a quantum circuit, you can kind of write it as a sum over path. And it turns out that by using sort of this average over randomness, you can kind of write this as a combinatorial sum, where you basically look at all the possible paths each bit can take, and you sum over basically all the allocations of the different possible paths among the bits. And in the large sort of end limit, you can kind of think about these multinomial sum. You can kind of almost approximate them as some kind of integral in a continuum limit. And it turns out that with the right normalization, you can kind of write down an integral where only the n appears only in the exponential as follows. So in the large end limit, you can kind of imagine that this is, you know, you can take a saddle point approximation and try to evaluate this integral, and indeed that gives you an answer. And what we have shown in this paper is that this answer, which is completely non-rigorous because of, you know, various assumptions that we made in getting to this point, such as the saddle point approximation, this actually can be shown to be rigorously correct using a combinatorial proof that is based on this generalized multinomial theorem. So this was actually a very nice kind of a remarkable way to be able to do calculations in these models. And we can use these calculational methods to show results such as the concentration properties by basically calculating the second moment of the energies that shows up in these random models. And what we have shown is actually the second moment it agrees with the square of the first moment, which implies actually that the QAOA in these all fuel connected models can have very strong concentration properties. In particular, that implies two things. The first one being that the QAOA is actually the energy achieved by the QAOA is concentrated over the randomness of the instances. So this means that if you look at the expectation of the energy of different instances in any sort of parameters, and if you look at it different, if you look at different instances drawn from the same ensemble, the energy landscape over the parameters are essentially the same. And the second implication of this is that not only is it concentrated over instances, but if you actually just look at the measurement output of a typical graph or a typical problem that you draw from the ensemble, the output of the measurement also concentrates at this average value. But you know, this also has some very important implications practically. For example, the fact that it concentrates over instances, which means that you can actually reuse optimized parameters for similar instances drawn from the same ensemble. And even though similar sort of concentration results have been shown in the past, our calculations was able to show that this is true even in a non-local regime, for example, when you have RTOR graphs. So this is sort of concludes the first part of my talk. Just to kind of briefly summarize, for the problem of minimizing classical spin glasses, we're able to perform rigorous average case analysis of the QAOA to high depth, and this is enabled by sort of a method that gives rigorous results that uses only 2 to the p costs, which is much better than the doubly exponential costs previously for worst case analysis. And these results allow us to show that there is a sort of a quantum advantage in solving max cut problems on random graphs. In particular, we show that the QAOA is able to be the best proven performance of any classical algorithm. But even assuming sort of reasonable conjectures, the QAOA still seems to have a quadratic advantage. And we have also shown that there's methods to analyze QAOA on harder, more general problems. You can kind of think about this in terms of the intuition of path integrals. And we can also show results such as concentration, as I mentioned. Okay, so now if there are no questions about this part, I can take questions now, or if there are questions, but I can also move on to the second part if there are no questions. Okay, so I'll move on to the second part of my talk, which will be about minimizing the energy of quantum systems. So this is based on a recent work. The archive number is wrong here. So this was actually from last September. So this is work done with Anthony Chen, Robert Huang, and John Preskill, all of which were at Caltech when this work was completed. So. The problem, the problem of minimizing energy of quantum systems is very interesting because we know from complexity theory that the problem of finding ground states of a general many-body system is something called QMA hard. And with this QMA hardness result implies that in general, quantum computers cannot find ground states of quantum systems. And this also implies that, you know, nature, you know, assuming that, you know, nature can be simulated on quantum computers, can also not find ground states of quantum systems in general. And this is indeed what we see, for example, in systems like spin glasses. And that also means that, you know, maybe ground states are not always physically relevant. And instead, you know, maybe when a physical system is placed in a low temperature thermal bath in nature, for example, it usually seeks a local minimum of the energy, which might be far from the global minimum. So this kind of leads us to perhaps hypothesize that maybe local minima are more physical notions than global minima or ground states. So motivated by this perspective, we asked the question, okay, how tractable is the problem of finding a local minimum using classical or quantum computers? Well, we address this question by proving that a machine that cools physical system to a local minimum is a universal quantum computer. And hence, under the standard assumption that quantum computers cannot be classically simulated, this also implies that finding a local minimum of quantum system is classically hard and quantumly easy. So this shows us that, you know, this problem of local minimum is potentially, you know, a way to achieve a quantum advantage. So now I'll delve into our results in more detail. But first, I will need to define what we mean by a local minimum in quantum systems. So our definition is sort of based on standard definitions in the field of mathematical optimization. So the idea is that you know, consider a domain of all n qubit states specified by some density matrix rho. And we assign each state an energy from a Hamiltonian H that governs the quantum system. And to set the energy landscape, we also need to specify a family of perturbations that enable you to move between quantum states with vector theta that parameterizes the strength and directions of the perturbations. So given these three things, we say that a state rho is an epsilon approximate local minimum if perturbing the state in any direction can only increase the energy for all small enough theta up to an error that scales as epsilon times the perturbation strength. So this is sort of very mathematical, but more pictorially, if you kind of look at a state as a point in the energy landscape, for example, let's look at this cartoon version of an energy landscape in 1D on the left. If you look at any state, we say that it is an approximate local minimum as long as there's a neighborhood of states whose energy that remains above sort of this negative epsilon gradient line. So for example, the left point will be an epsilon approximate local minimum, but not the right point. So to further kind of, you know, cement our intuition about what is a local minimum, let's consider, you know, these five points in this 1D kind of landscape. By our definition, the point A, C, and D and E are epsilon approximate local minimum, but B is not. And so this sort of includes sort of maybe sort of non-trivial cases like point A, whose local gradient is non-zero, but is constrained so that the energy can only increase with perturbations, as well as point D, which lies on top of a sufficiently flat plateau in the energy landscape. So we consider all such points as local minimum in our definition. So now that we're on the same page of what a local minimum is, I will define a problem of finding a local minimum in a quantum system. So the problem is specified by four input. First, the Hamiltonian H of the system, which for technical reasons, we will assume to have polynomially bounded energy. And then we also need a family of perturbations, which sets the landscape. We also need a precision parameter epsilon, which again, for technical reasons, we will assume to be inverse polynomially large. And finally, we'll also take as input an observable, usually local observable, which we will use to characterize the local minimum state. So given these four input, the task of finding a local minimum is to output the estimated value of an observable expectation within epsilon error for any epsilon approximate local minimum under the perturbations. And I will stress that this problem is not a decision problem as usually studied in the setting of complexity theory, since there might be multiple acceptable output corresponding to different local minima in a system. For example, in this 1D landscape, if you give me the expectation at any of these four points, you will be considered okay. And furthermore, I will note that this is a problem with purely classical input and output. So this gives the classical computers also a way to potentially tackle it. So because of this, we can kind of compare, you know, the classical and quantum computational complexity for this problem.
Just a question. So sorry, what was n?
N is the n is the problem system size. So the number of
system size. Okay. Yeah. And then, is there some requirement that H be like efficiently describable? Like
yes. I mean, H needs to have a succinct description because that's part of the input.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. Thanks.
So as an example, let's first consider local minimum of quantum systems under local unitary perturbations. So here the perturbations are specified by short-time unitary evolutions generated by one or two qubit Pauli operators. So these perturbations are mathematically simple, and they're commonly considered in algorithms like adaptive variational quantum eigensolvers. But furthermore, the landscape generated by these perturbations is actually a Riemannian manifold over quantum states, and it's sort of the state version of the manifold of over quantum unitaries, defining it is sort of the seminal work titled Quantum Computation as Geometry by Nielsen and others. So this is sort of a kind of a natural set of perturbations to consider, but it turns out that the local minimum problem becomes too easy under these perturbations that even a classical computer can solve them trivially. And this is because for any local Hamiltonian, we can show that any random state is an approximate local minimum for any sort of epsilon that you will care about. And because of the fact that any random state, and this follows from the fact that the expectation of local observables from any hard random state concentrate exponentially, and this is sort of the reason that underlies sort of the well-known Baryon plateau phenomenon in many variational quantum algorithms. So as a consequence of this, because there, any quantum random quantum state is a local minimum, there are doubly exponentially many local minima in the energy landscape for any local Hamiltonian. And in this case, the local minimum problem becomes too easy and can be solved, for example, by outputting the observable expectation in the maximally mixed state. And aside from being classically easy, the energy landscape defined by local unitary perturbations is not physically well motivated, because nature usually performs non-unitary operations on open quantum systems. So for the rest of my talk, we will consider these nature-inspired thermal perturbations, which I will describe now. So these perturbations are generated by continuous time Lindblad superoperators. And the specific form of these thermal Lindblad that we use is based on a rigorous version of the Davis equation derived by Moskvinov and Lidar. And they're used to describe the dynamics of open quantum systems that are weakly coupled to a memoryless thermal bath. Although in general, the system bath interactions can be very complicated, it turns out that this Lindbladian can be actually fully specified by just a few thermodynamic properties of the bath, such as the inverse temperature, beta, as well as a characteristic time scale, tau. And in addition, you need to specify the local jump operators through which the bath interacts with the system. And generally, if you look at a jump operator in the energy eigenbasis, you can either sort of add or remove energy from the system. So in these thermal Lindbladians, it has a very nice property in the sense that the temperature of the bath sets a transition rate, which favors cooling over heating operations. So given these thermal perturbations that now specify energy landscape of quantum systems, we now give a new quantum optimization algorithm, which we call a quantum thermal gradient descent, that turns out that you can efficiently find local minima of quantum systems under these thermal perturbations. So the idea is actually quite simple. If you consider any n-qubit Hamiltonian whose Hamiltonian H has energy that's bounded by some parameter B, then to find an epsilon local approximate local minimum under the thermal perturbations, you can proceed as follows. So first you initialize the system at any state, which for example can be taken as the maximally mixed state for simplicity. Then for each time step, we first estimate the gradient with respect to each jump operator in the Lindbladian, for example, by using the finite difference method, or more sophisticatedly, you can try to use block encoding of the Lindbladian adjoint applied to the Hamiltonian H. And if all the gradients are not very negative, we can actually terminate the algorithm because we have found a local minimum. Otherwise, if there is a sufficiently negative gradient direction, you can then evolve the system with the Lindbladian terms that has the negative gradients. And you can, for example, implement this Lindbladian's evolution on a quantum computer using a black box sort of Lindbladian simulation framework that was recently kind of developed by Chen and others. Sorry, I don't have a citation here, but I'm happy to provide it later if there's a question about this. So using a fairly straightforward arguments, you can show that, you know, this algorithm provably converges in the number of steps that's polynomial in the number in the energy bound B, as well as the precision parameter epsilon. And thus this, you know, this means that, you know, we have shown that finding the local minimum of a quantum system using this algorithm can be done in polynomial time, and it thus is quantumly easy. Now, we'll also show that the problem of finding local minimum under thermal perturbations is also classically hard. And for this, we'll prove the following theorem. It turns out that certain 2D Hamiltonians whose ground states includes universal quantum computation has a very nice property in the sense that they have no suboptimal local minima when the precision parameters epsilon, beta, and the bath parameters beta and tau are sufficiently large. This means that for these Hamiltonians, the energy landscape has a very nice bow shape, and every state can flow to the unique local minimum, which is the ground state. To give you more detail, these Hamiltonians are a modified version of the Gitaev circuit Hamiltonian, where the idea is that if you give me any quantum circuit UC, there's a corresponding geometrically local Hamiltonian HC in two dimension, such that the ground state is a weighted superposition over all computational history of the quantum circuit. And as a result, measuring any observable in this unique local minimum of such a Hamiltonian is the same thing as measuring observables in the output state of the quantum circuit. And assuming the standard assumption that the quantum circuits cannot be classically simulated, that implies that finding any local minimum of HC must be classically hard. So for the remainder of my talk, I will just briefly tell you about sort of the most technically challenging part of our result, which is the characterization of the energy landscape of these circuit Hamiltonians. And I will briefly sketch the proof idea behind this theorem that I just showed. But to begin, I will firstly briefly explain how we map any quantum circuit to the 2D Hamiltonian in more detail, which this uses sort of relatively standard techniques in Hamiltonian complexity theory. So given any 2D quantum circuit, we first write it in the standard 1D brickwork layout form, and then we can convert it to a sparse 2D circuit by adding a bunch of ancilla qubits and swap gates. So this 2D circuit has an important property that every qubit is acted on by only a constant number of gates in a geometrically local way. And then by applying circuit Hamiltonian construction pioneered by Kitaev and others, we can write down a two-dimensional BQP hard Hamiltonian HC acting on the qubits in the circuit, as well as the T extra ancilla qubits that form sort of the so-called clock register. The various turns in the Hamiltonian ensures that the HC has a unique ground state, which is a superposition over all computational history of the circuit. So what I've told you so far is sort of a fairly standard construction, but our goal here is really to characterize the energy landscape of this BQP hard Hamiltonian and show that it has no suboptimal local minima. To show this, we propose sort of a mathematically natural and sufficient condition for this property, which we call the negative gradient condition. This is the following operator inequality related to the Lindblomian adjoint acting on the system Hamiltonian, and we relate this to the projector onto the ground state of the Hamiltonian. But essentially what this operator inequality says is that any excited states must have good gradients, since if you convert this to the state version, it says that the energy decreases whenever the state is not in the ground state subspace. Okay, but proving this condition seems daunting, because now we need to worry about all possible arbitrary superposition of excited states of HC, not just the ground states, which has been the primary focus of previous studies on these circuit Hamiltonians. But to do this, our key proof idea is to analyze energy gradients perturbatively. So consider the situation where you have a Hamiltonian H, which has many degenerate eigenspaces separated by large spectral gaps. we want to characterize the gradients in H prime, which is obtained by from H by adding a perturbation that splits but not mixes the different degenerate subspaces. And we show the following lemma. If the excited states of H have good gradients, then so does the corresponding perturbed states of H prime. And this really, you know, is very helpful because it simplifies our task of proving that the excited states of H prime have good gradients, because we only need to focus on the perturbed subspaces P prime without worrying about all the complicated excited states of H prime. I will also make a brief remark that to prove this lemma, standard perturbative arguments doesn't work. And this is because it turns out that the error in these thermal embodiments are suppressed not by spectral gaps, but by the so-called Bohr frequency gaps, which refers to the minimum difference of differences of energy eigenvalues. And this can be often much smaller than the spectral gap, but in our cases, we're able to ensure a large Bohr frequency gap by modifying the circuit Hamiltonian construction. So then the proof of the theorem proceeds by considering the three parts of the BQP hard Hamiltonian in a sequence, each as a perturbation on the previous one using a hierarchy of energy scales. So using the perturbative gradient lemma in the previous slide, we can sequentially rule out the local minima in the excited states of the first Hamiltonian, and then the second Hamiltonian, and finally the third Hamiltonian as follows. So by doing this, we show that all the excited states of the final Hamiltonian, which is our BQP hard Hamiltonian, have gradients, which implies that the only local minimum really in this circuit Hamiltonian is the ground state. And that concludes our proof sketch. And I will then tell you a little bit more about the implication of our results, if there's no questions. Okay, so in summary, we have shown that, you know, for 2D systems, certain 2D quantum systems, finding a local minimum of thermal perturbations is classically hard and quantumly easy. This implies that there is a quantum advantage in coding to local minima of these quantum systems. But we also know that for typical physical systems, classical algorithms are nonetheless used routinely and often with great success. I mean, there are also cases where they appear to fail, but it's also hard to rule out whether or not, you know, there's not a more sophisticated classical algorithm that does better. So this begs the question, okay, how do we identify more quantum systems where quantum can be classical? I'll tell you one possible method. So for example, if you give me a system of interest, such as a complex molecule, and usually a classical algorithm for minimizing energy of the molecule works by exploring the energy landscape defined by classical ansatz, such as a tensor network or a neural network ansatz. And this algorithm starts with an educated guess of a low energy state, and then it updates the ansatz parameters to find a local minimum of the energy within this classical ansatz energy landscape. However, we also know that in some cases, such as the 2D BQP hard Hamiltonian, the classical algorithm cannot find a true local minimum. So our idea for detecting quantum advantage is to evaluate the thermal gradient in these classically optimized ansatz state. So in the Heisenberg picture, this gradient is sort of the expectation of the adjoining embodiment applied to the Hamiltonian. And in many cases, this is actually a quasi-local observable, which may be evaluated classically on many classical ansatzes. And if we see a sufficiently negative gradient, this means that applying quantum thermal gradient descent, for example, can move the state in a direction that further lowers the energy. And this identifies for the case, if we see a negative gradient, a quantum advantage for this molecule, for example. And if we see this for an interesting molecule, this will motivate us to build a quantum computer so we can upload this classical ansatz state to the quantum computer and take additional steps with a quantum gradient descent to find a better energy state. Now I will conclude my talk by summarizing what I have discussed so far. So what I have shown you is that there are actually good rigorous theoretical evidence for quantum advantages in energy minimizations. In particular, for classical systems, we show that there are quantum advantages for minimizing certain diluted spin glasses. And for quantum systems, we show that the problem of local minima, which is motivated by quantum thermodynamics, It seems to be a very nice a problem in the sense that for certain computationally hard problem, we can characterize the energy landscape to show that it has no suboptimal local minima, and it has a very nice property that the worst case complexity of finding a local minimum is classically hard and quantumly easy. And as outlook, I'll give you the following kind of open questions. So for classical systems, I have shown you that we can, you know, rigorously analyze the QAOA kind of energy at basically a very large but constant depth. But we have not been able to show the asymptotic behavior rigorously, although we do have a fit that seems to be somewhat convincing. And it would be very nice if we can rigorously prove convergence to the ground energy, which is the pre-C value. But furthermore, most of the existing rigorous results on algorithms like the QAOA is only true when the depth P is at most logarithmic in the problem size. So and because you know because we know that you know in general P as P increases the QAOA can always solve the problem and there's a lot of you know there's a lot of space between logarithmic depth as an exponential depth. So it'll be very interesting to develop techniques where we can analyze the QAOA when P is more than just a logarithmic growth. And more broadly speaking, I think that there's a lot of interesting questions at the frontier of quantum algorithms for classical problems over random structure. And this random optimization is just one example. And this is a very interesting area because recent studies in high dimensional statistics have uncovered multiple barriers in problems that causes many classical algorithms to fail. And these are just known as statistical computational gaps in some literature, which basically refers to situations where we know certain solutions of quality exist by statistical theory, but finding those solutions are computationally hard. And this gives us a lot of opportunities to develop and analyze quantum algorithms that potentially achieves a strong quantum advantage. Now, on the quantum side, there's also a number of very interesting directions. First, as I already mentioned, it is very interesting if we can identify more systems for quantum advantage. And for example, we can try to do this by evaluate developing efficient methods to evaluate gradients, thermal gradients of classical classically optimized ansatzes. Furthermore, sometimes the energy landscape of certain quantum systems might be bad in the sense that it contains many local minimum. And quantum thermal gradient descent might be stuck at a suboptimal local minima. So it will be interesting in these cases to study the mixing time, for example, of a quantum Markov chain method that potentially can take you out of a suboptimal local minima. And I think it will be also interesting to consider more general, potentially nonlinear energy function, for example, by constraining the quantum state to states with a fixed charge sector or some kind of desirable entanglement properties, and also by sort of you know considering, for example, the free energy, you can also potentially prepare Gibbs states more efficiently. And in general, we believe that the understanding the energy landscape of general quantum system is an important open question that might help us to understand not only quantum advantages but also many body physics, and potentially could serve as a new perspective to classify quantum phases. So that's the end of my talk, and I'm happy to take more questions.
All right, thanks. Yeah, thanks a lot for the super interesting talk. Do we have other questions?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, of course.
So I'm not familiar with those topics, so I want to ask a basic question. So can you give me an example of a BQP Hamiltonian?
Yeah, so let me just maybe bring up this slide. So this is essentially what an example of a BQP hard Hamiltonian looks like. You have three terms in the Hamiltonian, H-clock, H-in, and H-prop. H-clock basically says... So basically, in this Hamiltonian, you have computational qubits, the system qubits here, as well as clock qubits. And the clock part of the Hamiltonian basically sets certain states to be so-called legal clock says that basically encodes the time axis of whatever circuit that you're trying to encode as the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And the in part of the Hamiltonian fixes the initial state to the quantum circuit to be all zero. And the last part of the Hamiltonian ensures that as you move between different time in the time register, you're applying the corresponding unitary gate. So with some work, you can show that you know the unique ground state of these Hamiltonian when you have all three terms is a superposition over all computational history of the quantum circuit.
And what's BQP about this? I mean, like, what makes it difficult for classical computer to simulate it?
Well, if you can measure properties of, for example, any local observable in the ground state, then you're basically calculating the expectation of an observable in the quantum circuit, right? So that is essentially a BQP hard problem, right? Mm-hmm. Any quantum computational problem can be encoding the circuit model as measuring the observable in the output of a quantum circuit. So assuming that quantum circuits cannot be simulated classically, you know, this problem is classically hard.
Thank you.
Hi, can you comment on how difficult it is to implement the quantum gradient descent on like a quantum computer?
Yes, that's a very good question. So currently, I guess to implement it exactly as written, we need to basically simulate the Limbladian dynamics efficiently. And the way that we know how to do this, like kind of fully, is currently uses sort of this block encoding and a version of the quantum singular value transform. So for that, maybe it requires at least some version of a fault tolerant quantum computer. But it turns out that there's actually a more simple version of this. So there's a paper by Anthony Chen and Linden and one of Linden's students, I forgot his name, sorry. Where they look at basically not this Limbladian, but sort of a model where they apply they only use one ancilla qubit, a single ancilla, and they basically you know you evolves only with the control evolution of the Hamiltonian both forward and backwards in time, and with that they were able to sort of you know and also they measure the ancilla qubits periodically so they pump out the entropy. So by basically doing this kind of controlled forward and backwards Hamiltonian evolution, as well as mid-circuit measurement and feedback, you're able to also simulate a version of this kind of you know Limbladian evolution in some sense. So I think that's maybe the simplest version that we know so far, and that could be done you know maybe on a you know early fault tolerant quantum computer where you can do basically both forward and backward evolution of the Hamiltonian in a control way efficiently. So you know, I think, yeah, I mean, as long as you can do those things, I think you can implement essentially a version of this algorithm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks.
Tim, you wanna go ahead?
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Leo. Yeah, thanks for the great talk. So I was interested in this last point you made about possible connection to phases of matter. So the way I interpret it is maybe you want to consider each local minima as maybe different phases because around each minima there's a you know short time Limbladian that takes you to nearby points.
That could be interesting interpretation of this. I mean, I think I leave it as maybe a kind of a vague open question. But what I have in mind is, you know, I actually look at the energy landscape as a whole, for example, characterizing the number of local minima, as well as the distances between local minima, and the qualities of the local minima. So for example, you know, this is a way to understand and actually define classical spin glasses by looking at basically the overlap between, you know, near ground states of sort of classical systems. But also furthermore, I think another interesting example would be, you know, maybe a system with topological order, for example, could have multiple local minima that are very far apart because, you know, it takes more than just a local move to go from one ground state to another. So that could be another way to maybe understand, you know, topological order, for example. But these are just, you know, two examples. I think, you know, maybe the neatest connection is to quantum stained glasses, because currently we don't really have a agreed upon like kind of, you know, good definition of what a quantum stained glass is. And classically, people understand this by looking at, you know, classical kind of local minimas, essentially, in the bit string basis. And here, you know, by characterizing, and they're basically, they characterize, you know, the number of local minimas and the sort of distance between them. And I think maybe kind of looking at a similar generalized notion in the quantum setting, like looking at this energy landscape, could make us, help us understand these phases, and maybe, you know, maybe develop new ways of kind of looking at non-equilibrium quantum systems as well.
I see. Thanks.
Further questions? Okay. So if not, we'll leave it there. It's unfortunate, Leo, we weren't able to set up a visit, but you should, I assume, feel free to email him and bug him with other questions if they come up. And I'll remind you that we have lunch in the bistro now with the group. And yeah, let's thank Leo once again.
Well, and thank you again for inviting me.